Aren't you tired of the culture wars? No side is winning, and it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. In a free country that actually has seen some uncivil and civil wars in the name of entitlement. I see you nodding your heads, but it's not what you think. Entitlement is the slave owner who kept people in chains and as property, as if any person could own another person. Entitlement is fighting for that right to keep it going and to think you have a right to dehumanize another human being because it is a family right. I think what we really need is to cease fire and let the games begin. Let's look at the playing field as 50 states that work together as a team. Let's call it the melting pot.
Is there an economic gap in our country? Is it racial, educational, and does wealth have to be redistributed? Hello, everyone. My name is Richard Arnold Beatty, and you're listening to Useful to God Radio with Dr. James Spencer. James, I asked a rhetorical question about economics in this country, and to make it more concrete, there's a little history. The Industrial Revolution that occurred in many places of the world between the Victorian Age and the turn of the 20th century caused us to go from farm to factory in a fortnight. The same farmers who were plowing the land were building railroads on the same property. Then came World War I, and nothing was the same ever since. By 1929, after the industrial and economic growth, there was prohibition and a correction of fates called the Great Depression, World War II, and then the New Deal. We are introduced to welfare, Social Security, labor unions, and a word we hear quite often right now, entitlement. Now, I frame this without giving consideration of where God is during these times and where the church is. We understand that there were revivals. There's a difference between the urban church, the black church, and rural churches. How does this history play out in the culture war?
I'm always sort of drawn to a Dutch scholar named Johan Huizinga, and he talks about every man building for himself a representation of the past, an understanding of the past that is very much rooted in one's present learnings and understandings. And so I think sometimes we have this impression that the past is some sort of an objective thing that we can just look at and point to and say, look, that's exactly how it was back then. But the reality is that the past influences our perception of it. The present influences our perception of the past. And so as we're looking back on history, part of what we're really doing is we are selecting those aspects of history that really serve our present day interests. And we're trying to find resources from history as sort of quasi-authorities that are going to help bolster our positions. And so as we do that, what we ultimately end up with are some contentious readings of history, right? And so, for instance, there are some who say that America was founded as a Christian nation. There are other people who say that America was not founded as a Christian nation. But I think when you look at the history and you look at as much of the history as possible, what you realize is that the truth probably lies somewhere in between there, that there's a more complex history than can be summarized in a one sentence sort of statement. And so that's shorthand, I think, for something. Fortunately, when you use hand enough, we sort of lose the nuance that it's supposed to carry. Greg Finke from Dwelling 114 is joining us. You know, the church and non-exempt status for churches is a curious system. Again, when you're looking back at the past and you're thinking about culture wars, this negotiation of the distinction between church and state, or the separation of church and state, the non-establishment of religion, all those kind of things, has been fairly contentious across the history of the United States. But it's become a system that has united a secular system with a sacred institution to some degree. There's at least a provision made to allow space for non-exempt status for nonprofit organizations, which often includes churches and other religious organizations. Does that blunt any of our tools for disciple making? Does it make us too dependent on the state?
Going back to your comments about history and how we perceive it and then kind of make it say what we want to say, there is a sense that the way we do it these days, you know, 21st century America, is the way it should be done, right? A church to be a tax exempt has to apply for a 501c3. I mean, it's great, I suppose, but it has nothing to do with the Bible. And in fact, I would say that while the purpose of the 501c3 is simply an economic one from the state trying to give churches some sense of a economic break, the reality is that the church has allowed the 501c3 to, in a, I think, a very detrimental way, we have now kind of molded ourselves to it. Let me give you an example. These days, when I go to a church, I need to find the chair or the president. Right. There's a treasurer that holds a lot of sway. There's a board of directors or some group that is going to be responsible for the 501c3. Now, we tend to put spiritual kind of constructs on those things. But the reality is, now that we are raising up leaders in our churches, they tend to be organizational leaders. They tend to be leaders that do a good job of running a meeting or untangling a spreadsheet, rather than what the Bible gives us of raising up leaders. And that is, like Hebrews 13:7, take note of the outcome of your leader's way of life and imitate their faith. Well, where do I go at church to find those folks, right? They don't have a title. They don't have an office. They don't meet in a conference room. And therefore, they are often overlooked and underappreciated, and the church is suffers because of it. Rather than identifying who are those people that we want our folks to know and imitate, so we have more and more people living that way, it's the other way. We look for folks that are good with finance, that are good with Robert's rule of order or whatever, good with legalities and budgets. And again, we need those people. Don't get me wrong. We're not disenfranchising them, but we have this kind of tweaked system now that's more about the organization than it is about discipling people and what it looks like to live a life of love for the good of others. But was the misapplication of God's word to the United States over and over again, that words of God that were spoken by the prophets, spoken in the writings of the Psalms and Proverbs, were not written about the United States. They were written about the nation of Israel. And we have co-opted them and acted like, hey, God's talking about us. And while there's application to any, you know, people in any nation, when we start to think, hey, what God's saying is, you know, God needs to bless America because we're the, you know, we're the Christian nation. Now just ask anybody what's a Christian nation and you'll get a, you know, a Baptist, a Catholic, a Lutheran, Episcopalian will all give you something different anyway. So I'm not sure how God's supposed to sort that out. Of course, God doesn't have to sort it out. By whose definition are we Christian? Yeah.
Followers of Jesus were first called Christians in Antioch. Acts 11:26 says, "For a whole year, Barnabas and Saul met with the church and taught great numbers of people." The disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. They were called Christians because their speech and behavior were like Christ.
Coming to the Table is the name of the group. It's a group that Dr. Martin Luther King was instrumental in starting and supporting. It is an interracial community group throughout the country. So they have their basic charters and communities. They discuss and take some activist role in consideration of economic reparations for slavery and historic discrimination. Greg, I think of what you're doing, and I wondered if there are some goals that the Christian church can shoot for in the area of racial injustice?
Well, I think so. I mean, and simply because, you know, we are ambassadors of Christ's reconciliation. And so to be able to look throughout the, you know, the history, not only of the Old Testament, where the command of God was that they would welcome the alien and the foreigner, but then going into the New Testament and how we are sent out to the nations, you know, there is a reality of being able to have that which is wounded, that which is broken, that which is alienated one from another, reconciled, you know, in the forgiveness and blood of the Lamb, and to be able to live in a sense of harmony. Again, not a utopia. God will indeed bring this all to pass, like we see in Revelation, where every tribe, nation, language, and people are, you know, celebrating their salvation. They worship the Lamb. But in these days, we get to be a taste of the kingdom. We get to be a glimpse of what is coming, and working to be reconcilers, I think, is fundamentally what we get to be about. And whether that's, you know, between any people groups, you know, one of the things that I think is sad is that no matter how small a group of people you get, they'll still find ways to find differences and hate each other, right? They could be completely alike in every way, and yet they're still that way. What was it, the Dr. Seuss book, where somebody buttered their bread on one side and somebody else buttered the bread on the other, and
the other.
Their reason for hating each other? It's like, yep, that's humanity for you. And so for us to be indeed transformed by the cross, and to then go, hey, now I get to be a way that forgiveness and reconciliation is experienced, or at least offered, and therefore God helps them experience it, is a beautiful thing. I can't help but think about Jesus and his own 12 disciples. Think about that. Jesus, with this small group of guys, couldn't have gathered a more volatile group. You got Peter and Andrew, James and John, who maybe they were buddies, but probably they were competitors, right? There's only so much fish and so much market for fish along the Sea of Galilee. Then you got Matthew, who was the tax collector for all four of them. Then you throw in a zealot, and on it goes. And that Jesus, that's his posse. That's his group that he's interacting with. And so right from the get-go, there is not just this talking and preaching about reconciliation, but this hard work of working it out. And right there, just on his own team.
So is there a danger in becoming unclean or stained by reaching out? And how do we guard against becoming tainted by the world that we're trying to help?
I think there's always a danger in that. When we start to look out at the world and we see all the problems, we can become overwhelmed by compassion and begin to think that what we need to do is just to alleviate pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely appropriate for us to alleviate pain and suffering when we can.
Right.
But if our sole goal becomes, let's make sure that humanity feels no pain, I'm not sure that that's a goal that we are well equipped to accomplish. And it certainly isn't a goal that should overshadow proclaiming the gospel. If you think about it, you know, there's a lot of groups, nonprofit groups, humanitarian aid groups, even churches and other organizations that try to help people in need. There's a lot of those kind of groups, whether secular or Christian. But Christians are the only people on this planet who can proclaim Jesus Christ. We're the only people on this planet who have the final solution to the ailments of humanity because Christ overcame sin and death. Those aren't answers that any other group of people are going to be able to give because we've had God's word revealed to us. We believe it. We live according to God's word. And so we're the only group who can do that task. And so if we think about it like that, we need to just make sure that as we're reaching out to the world, that that task remains front and center for us always. Anything else that we're doing has to flow from that task. And I think that's the trick of remaining unstained by the world. We don't allow the world to supplant that logic or to push that message into the back seat. We're always trying to convey that unique message that only we can provide.
So we actually should not be at war that shouldn't be our approach with the culture, right?
It's tough to think of being at war with the culture because, you know, you think about even something like Ephesians 6, you know, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the powers and the principalities of the world. And so what we're really fighting against is not other people.
Right.
Other people are lost. Mm-hmm. Other people are like we were before we were saved by Christ.
Right.
They're fallen. They're broken. They're sinful. They're separated from God. They're living in ignorance of Him. And so, no, they're not our enemies.
Right.
They're the lost sheep that we're trying to bring into the fold. Mm-hmm. What we're fighting against are the principalities that stand behind those things. It's the intervening logics, the ideologies that try to make sense of the world and give people a story and a direction that allows them to live life apart from Christ. And that's what we're pushing against always.
Queer theory is a species in this genus. Post-colonial theory that's plaguing Europe is a species in this genus. And they have something that binds them together called intersectionality, that makes them treated as if they are all one thing. But the logic is Marxist, and I want to convince you of that. Because Marx had a very simple proposition, but we get lost. We think that Marx was talking about economics because he often talked about economics. He wrote a book called Capital. It's a very famous book. And we think, well, this is about economic theory. But this isn't true. It's always true on the surface. We go below the surface. What Marx was talking about was something different. We know what Marx's hypothesis was that we must seize the means of production if we're going to bring socialism to the nations, to the world. We have to seize the means of production. So we have to ask, what does he mean? And if we think that it's about capital, then we miss what he means. If you think it's about the means of production in the factory with a hammer, and the means of production in the field with a sickle, then you miss what it means. Because Marx explained what makes human beings special in his earlier writings. And what makes human beings special is that man is a being that is incomplete and knows that he is incomplete. He is a man whose true nature has been forgotten to him, which is social being. He is a socialist at heart who doesn't realize it. And the reason he doesn't realize it is because of the economic conditions operating as a means of construction or production, not just of the economy, but of him, but of man, of society, and particularly of history. Marx said that he had the first scientific study of history. How is history produced? By man, doing man's activity, and man's key activity was economic activity, as he saw it. And so economic production doesn't just produce the goods and services of the economy, it produces society itself. And society, in turn, produces man. He called this the inversion of praxis.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this opening keynote on the Sunday Battle of Ideas. I'm Claire Fox, and I'm the director of the Academy of Ideas. And to be honest, this session, which is Are the Culture Wars a Distraction, is very close to my heart. Regularly, whether I do media or speeches in other events, I'm accused of stirring up the culture wars, that I'm somehow being manipulated by the US imported alt-right funded by mad Christians, and that I'm trying to distract everyone from the real politics, like the cost of living crisis or real wars such as Ukraine, or of course now a very real war in terms of Israel and Gaza. In other words, I'm accused of fiddling while Rome burns. This panel, however, is not being asked, are you for or against the culture wars? Or are you for or against Claire Fox creating a distraction? Actually, I've asked the panel to mull things over and think aloud and actually try and get to grips with it. Because there is something irritating about people being cultural warriors without thought. And there is something irritating about people say the culture wars is just a distraction. So, as you know, the battle of ideas tries to dig deeper.
You know, this is an interesting area and a tough one, I think. But I was reading a book on Dwight Moody. It was a biography by Findlay. I believe it's James Findlay. In the book, he talks about the Industrial Revolution and the dependence that the church gains or the dependence that the church develops on big business. And he makes this comment. He just says, when the church became too dependent on big business, it became increasingly difficult for the church to criticize big business, to criticize the market outside of things like just basic, personal morality choices and issues. And I find it really telling when I read that, I was thinking, where are we so entwined or intertwined with these ideas and theories that we're no longer really able to criticize them? We've gotten too close. And I'm wondering if you think that this idea of racial justice, racial injustice, some of the theories about how to pull us together, how to, handle racial injustice, either historically or even in present day, have we gotten too embedded in those theories? Is this now the air that we're breathing in? And we just can't see clearly enough to actually criticize it from a theological perspective and break through to something that would actually be far more effective in drawing people together and uniting them in Christ than some of the strategies we're currently employing.
Yeah, I think the that's a brilliant way of saying it. It's almost like we need to take a big step back and realize that we got everything exactly backwards. We keep waiting for somebody, right? Whether it's a think tank or a legislative group or a judicial decision to come down that will be the answer, and then it'll all just happen. And that it's just not going to work that way. That's not the way reconciliation happens. It happens, person to person, community to community. And that's why, what I was saying before about that's part of our identity and purpose as God's people. And if we all go out and, we don't try to solve everybody's problems, but we go out and make sure that we're living reconciled one with another in our community. And then, one block and then another block, and pretty soon a small town, and maybe it spreads beyond. But the idea that we're waiting for it to be figured out and presented to our culture is just that it's not going to work that way. And unfortunately, that's pretty much what I think everybody talks about. It's never about what am I going to do about it. It's always what are they going to do about it? We're perfectly calibrated for the results we're getting.
Yes, perfectly calibrated for the results we are getting. That was Greg Finke. How about you, listener? Are we trained soldiers in a culture of war? Or are we trained as athletes ready to run a race? And to play this culture game, as cunning as snakes and as innocent as doves. Clips on Marxism in an address to the Parliament in London. We heard comments on the culture war in a conversation of ideas. Greg Finke, author and the president of Dwelling 114, and Dr. James Spencer, president of Useful to God and the Moody Center. A useful and thoughtful conversation. There was an excerpt from a show we did last year, Peace Talks to a Culture at War. Next week, Greg Finke will be back as we continue this audio docuseries we are calling Culture War and Its Effect on Humanity. For more, go to usefultogod.com. I'm Richard Arnold Beatty, Crawford Media, Denver. Yes, order when you're ready.
I'd like to order a book by Dr. James Spencer, but I can't decide between Useful to God or Christian Resistance.
How about Serpents and Doves?
No, I'm vegan.
You can still be vegan and read Serpents and Doves.
While eating hummus?
In moderation. Pull up to the second window.
Why not the first?
Well, there's a Baptist convention there. It's really wet.
Serpents and Doves, the new book from Dr. James Spencer. Get it at usefultogod.com, even if you're a vegetarian or vegan, or Baptist, Catholic, Presbyterian. It's just a good read.
More than a decade ago, there were a number of well-meaning organizations that had been broadcasting, publishing, and speaking of absolute truth, the dangers of relativism, and alternative reality. In recent years, these polarizing issues are exacerbated by extremists in areas of immigration, healthcare, economics, and wealth distribution, academics, literature, and labor. And then comes the environment and racial injustice. Hello, everybody. This is Richard Arnold Beatty, and along with Dr. James Spencer, we are going to talk with Greg Finke, the founder of Dwelling 114 and joining Jesus on his mission. James, I've been reading a really good book called Imaginable by a futurist and video game designer, Jane McGonigal. And now I have no idea where the author stands in her views on the church and faith. However, I find her approach on these issues to be hopeful and proactive. And her game-like approach is very refreshing. In our present time, there is a cultural struggle, and it filters down to religion, politics, and even culture and arts. Is the shared reality that we need to reestablish, is it defining what it means to love God and people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it always comes sort of back down to that, doesn't it? You know, when I sort of approach these issues, what I try to remember is a little bit about what Augustine taught. Augustine taught about the disordering of our desires. We have a difficulty really ordering our loves, in other words. And so as we look out on the world, we can expect disorder, and we can expect that disorder because people who do not know Christ cannot love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. And as we see, you know, when Jesus talks and answers various questions within the Gospels about what is the greatest commandment, that's the first one. And so if that is what we are to do as humanity, as sort of our first love is to be toward God, we have no hope, unless we can do that, of ordering the rest of our loves in any sort of appropriate manner. And so I think it's really crucial that we get people to fall in love with Jesus, that we get people to come to Jesus through faith, so that those loves can be reordered and our misdirected desires can be redirected toward God, what it would have us do.
Well, in a similar way, and maybe biblically and theologically, the approach that Greg Finke and his wife Susan take is kind of game-like, if you will, or maybe it's more social in that way. Maybe that's the first approach in not only believing in Jesus, but believing Jesus.
Yeah, Greg, I mean, I want to start out by talking about some observations. In learning how to love God and Jesus, you know, it's important to observe human nature and people, but how have you found there are commonly agreed to facts across political worldviews and values?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I have been able to discern kind of across the board, you know, facts that everybody has, but I have found that when I approach people with a combination of humility and showing interest, when we're able to get to a level of communicating and not debating or trying to sell one to another, there ends up being a lot more common ground than what one would have ever have thought looking at it from us, you know, kind of on paper, so to speak, or from a surface point of view. And I think Christians, we do believe in absolute truth. We believe God is absolute truth. Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. I think what we end up getting ourselves in trouble with, though, is we approach that, unfortunately, too often like the Pharisees, who thought they had absolute truth kind of nailed down too. And what they had nailed down was their understanding of absolute truth, which, of course, is not the same as absolute truth. And so we go into it thinking, hey, I'm right, you're wrong. What can you learn from me? Rather than me going in and kind of from that very beginning relationship of humility from God, back to God, and then to other people. And I don't think we in any way water down what is truth, but rather we end up having a better understanding of how God's truth is being applied beyond just our own experience and our own understandings. I can't help but think of how the Pharisees were aggravated by Jesus when he broke bread and had table fellowship with tax collectors and sinners, right? And why did Jesus do that? He wasn't watering down truth. he was establishing relationships so that truth would have a way of flowing. And that's what I find is kind of the, if you will, the secret sauce of interacting with people that are different than me and being able to learn from them so that they are willing to hear from me and look for those the common ground. What I find in terms of what is common is a sense of justice. In other words, people want things to be just rather than unjust. There is also a sense of wanting to have something that is beneficial to more than just the individual. And many times when we start getting into, well, how will we do that? That's where there can be differences of opinion that can become very hot very quick. But I think if we can say, hey, you know what? We versus me is actually a very Christian starting point. Instead of that becoming kind of the drawing of a line in the sand, that we can kind of build on that. And especially, you know, if you're not in some type of a policy creating position like a legislature or whatnot, there's a lot of room for us to take the long view and, you know, not worry about winning battles, but really more interested in winning, you know, a heart and a mind by the power of the Spirit, of course.
What do you see as commonly agreed to, though, values, let's say, in thinking Christian, you know, they're into the Christian worldview or religious worldviews? Are there ways to teach these facts that defy the polarization that we see?
Yeah, well, I think there's two ways of getting at that. There's the polarization that can happen between Christians, right? There's a reason there are different denominations and why there are folks that don't consider, you know, that we're in community one with another, or communion one with another. And then there's the added challenge of us being relating to those that would not identify themselves as followers of Jesus or Christians. But I think there's a reason, for instance, and this hopefully isn't too light of an illustration, but what kind of movies always move people, no matter what? There are always these movies that there's a redemption story, right? That some person that really is just a scoundrel has some kind of a life-changing experience and they become more gracious or more loving. Another aspect of that same kind of theme is when someone that has every right to hold against somebody chooses forgiveness instead. Those are powerful things and obviously are very central to the Christian message and life. And those are things that are valued that I sense that everybody has a sense of wanting life to be just or life to be make sense and be fair for all. And, you know, really, in many ways, that's kind of what our U.S. Constitution is set up to be able to safeguard that so that, you know, there's equal justice under the law. And yet people see that isn't always the case. And so that, you know, causes them to rise up and defend. And if there's pain there, that can turn into advocacy. And all of a sudden we've got, you know, what we call the culture wars. And really, at the base of that is usually a sense of wanting there to be a fairness, a justness for people that are seen as being downtrodden or taken advantage of. You know, that's just one aspect, but it has a lot of implications in our cultural and political systems.
You know, as you're sort of out and interacting with people, I mean, one of the things that I hear you saying is there's a closure that happens when people start to think about what the problem is that they're actually facing. There's a closure. In other words, there's an absolute truth that isn't exactly absolute. An ideology, as I usually teach it, is something that is less complete than it comports itself to be or claims itself to be. Right. And so there's this closure. And so as we look at things like ideologies or even conspiracy theories, that closure seems to me to be problematic. It's something that we almost need to get people past, because if they can't see the problem of sin, right, if they can't get down to that sort of spiritual aspect of this and understand that, you know, sin is the real problem, that Jesus is the real solution, we never really get that opportunity to help them understand why the world is not as it should be. And so just as you interact with people, how do you go about sort of massaging that in, helping people understand, like, yes, okay, some of these things you're saying are probably problematic, but isn't it deeper than that? Isn't there more here? Like, how do you go about having those conversations with folks?
Yeah, and that's very well articulated, because that's exactly how it usually happens, is that if I'm going in with a humility, a curiosity, and a showing of value, also known as love, then there's going to be more of an opportunity for us to interact. And what we have noted over and over again is love kind of opens the intake valve for truth. If there is no love, that intake valve, you know, remains tightly shut, and they stay in their little closed system that they're in. But a couple of things, especially with regards to people with their ideologies and even conspiracy theories, you know, a lot of times those are born out of some sense of pain, right? Some sense of brokenness, or perception that there is brokenness, that there's injustice, that there's somebody getting away with something. And, you know, I think one thing that we as God's people can kind of count on is that while we often feel like we have to come in and help people understand they are sinners, I think if we come in and understand that they already are hurting from the law, they may not understand it that way yet. They may not have it framed out that way yet, but that they already understand pain. They already understand brokenness. They already understand injustice. And if we can come in with a sense of compassion towards that and invite the story of where did that come from, not the solutions that end up looking like ideologies and conspiracy theories, but, you know, in their personal story, when did you begin to think this way? You know, why? What is valuable? There's got to be a story there. Would you mind sharing that with me? That's when we often get bound to a place where both the woundedness is more apparent, and our ability then to start serving or ministering or being a salve to that begins to be more effective as well. Like I try to remind people, God's love doesn't work every time, but it's the only thing that works, right? So, some people are going to stay hard, they're going to stay crazy, whatever. But it's amazing how many times when we just come in kind of like Jesus, right? We're Jesus followers, Jesus imitators. The only folks he really came at strong and in their faces were the Pharisees, which we got to realize ends up looking a lot like us times and not, which is very irritating. But for everybody else, he seems to have come in more as just as a servant, as someone interested, someone showing value, willing to, you know, show table fellowship for the sake of conversation, relationship, and right there, the kingdom comes and the will of the Father starts getting done.
Well, it sounds to me like when you have these conversations, I mean, part of the way you might go about dampening the difficulties associated with false information, right, or even partial information, is simply by adopting a posture where you're not going to be alarmed by anything that's said. You're just listening and taking it all in and trying to understand another person's perspective, as opposed to, and I think you said this earlier, arguing and debating with them. Yeah. And so do you find that to be I think it's probably the only way to approach it, honestly. But how effective do you really find that when somebody is really, you know, entrenched in a false idea or a partial idea? You know, at what point do you really recognize that they're ready for you to share what you know with them?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I wish there was a nice, you know, like a quadratic equation that
right.
would come out. It's like A plus B plus C and bam, here's your opportunity. And that's part of why, if we're going to really, if we see someone that is been taken captive by a way of thinking, an ideology, a conspiracy theory, and we think we're going to talk them out of it in one quick let's get down to brass tacks conversation. And then I can be done with it. I can, you know, kind of wipe my hands off and keep moving. That is the wrong approach. That's more about you. It's not about them. And I think that's really kind of the first step for us. And what I meant by coming at this with humility is if it's somebody that God is bringing across our path and that we have the opportunity to know, then we get to humble ourselves. And I say that in a positive way. We get to do this, right? We get to humble ourselves and begin a journey with that person, knowing that I'm not able to fix them, knowing that I can't solve this. And I think that's another part of the humility that we were talking about, that this is something that God will do, but he will do it through means. And that means he'll do it through our listening, our talking, are asking questions and being willing to have this over time, realizing that we may never see them completely free from this, but that this is the only way that they will become completely free of this, right? And so, so for instance, being able to really ask questions, you know, I'm more of a preacher teacher, so I'm ready to give you content, right? Rather than thus, you know, kind of taking on that servant nature and going, wait, I need to know as much about why this person thinks this, where it comes from, how are they connecting dots. Then I can ask questions that maybe cause them to reexamine some of that. And again, it may or may not happen all at once, but that begins then to maybe give the Holy Spirit what he needs to then, when the conversation's over and now they're just laying in bed at night, you know, these things continue to kind of percolate there because, hey, we got a third person involved with this conversation named the Holy Spirit.
Well, thinking about discipleship, you brought up the word humility so many times. You know, James, when we talk about discipleship, it's almost like it's a polarizing word in today's contentious culture. Is humility the key to it? Coming in it from a very honest standpoint, as far as discipleship, and then really being humble at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say definitely what I hear, and not to put words in Greg's mouth here, but what I would describe what he's saying is it's a discipled posture. We're orienting to the world as disciples. And as disciples, we start to recognize that it's not our job to fix the world. It's our job to be faithful in a world that only God can fix. And so part of what that means is that we approach the world as disciples. And I think that there's a real sense in which humility has to be part of that. Calmness needs to be part of that. Peacefulness needs to be a part of that. Obviously, we need to speak the truth. And there are times where anger is appropriate, where a whole range of emotions are appropriate within discipleship. But I think that oftentimes what we end up with is a defensiveness and a sense of almost entitlement that our view should be heard. And what I hear Greg describing is something very different than that. It is in the spirit of James 1, you know, let's be slow to speak, slow to anger, and quick to listen. And so that to me is not a polarizing concept. That's actually just the way that Christians are supposed to be in the world. And you know, what we're trying to do in my mind is, you know, if we look at the Great Commission, Christ's authority gives us the grounding to go out and make disciples of all nations. And so what we're really trying to do is to bring recruits underneath the authority of Christ. And one of the best ways that we can do that, and I think one of the essential ways we need to employ, is simply by living differently in a chaotic world. Can we live at peace in a chaotic world? Yes, we can. Because as Jesus says in Matthew 6, you know, do not have anxiety about these things. Do not worry about what you'll wear, what you'll eat. He closed the fields. He cares for the birds. He's going to care for us as well. And so this to me is about a disciple posture that allows us to interact with views with which we disagree without actually being defensive and trying to just shove our viewpoint down people's throats. It's about really understanding how to interact with people and having the emotional intelligence, stability, and really the spiritual calm to do that.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I hope you didn't misunderstand what I was saying. I meant the way sometimes our posture of discipleship sometimes can be polarizing. Not so much, but when we do what, and I wasn't trying to put words into Greg's mouth. I was just merely saying that is humility and honesty really the posture that we should be taking.
I would say so. And what I would just suggest is that as we do that, the more like disciples of Christ we become in the world, the more likely it is that we're going to be polarizing. That's the odd part. I don't know that we really need to be offensive in order to be polarizing. I think just by being disciples of Jesus Christ, the world will eventually hate us. And so, that is the difference. We are being discipled. We are becoming disciples of Christ. Those who don't know him are becoming disciples of something else. And so we are, in some sense, rival clans. But ultimately, we know that we don't win that, sort of war, that culture war, by picking up any other means than what Christ has given us. And so, yeah, I think humility is absolutely the correct approach to handle this. Like I said, there's a range of other things that we could do, but I think ultimately humility is a really great place to start.
Yeah.
If economic security and broken health systems increase our political and religious divides, which there's a case to be made for that, how do we think Christian and be ambitious in helping to heal those symptomatic problems?
Greg, before we dive into that, why don't you go ahead and harken back to that last topic if you had something else to finish up?
Yeah, well, and I appreciate, being able to go on to that very important subject that Richard brought up too. But the only other thing that I wanted to add it was the idea or the biblical definition of discipleship, I think, is something that is just completely misunderstood among so many people. And because of that misunderstanding, that muddledness, it ends up kind of, therefore, people kind of apply it to whatever they're already doing and hope it's discipleship. But like you were already saying, James, it's a disciple is one that is training to become more like Jesus, right? And Jesus says, this is how you'll know someone is been discipled by me. This is how you'll know that someone has been trained by me, is that they start to love like me, right? That's John 13. And so when we see people that almost feel like you were saying, the world will hate us. So it almost emboldens them to be jerks, right? It emboldens them to be Pharisaical and harsh and unloving. And that's why I think many in the world have this very negative understanding of Christians or disciples because that's been their experience, rather than like Peter says in his first epistle, hey, if you're going to have folks persecute you, be persecuted because you're doing a good job of loving, right?
That's right.
And you're right. That will, by the forces of darkness, that love and grace and will also be seen as contentious and will be a target of persecution. But that's the kind that is blessed when Jesus says, blessed are those who are persecuted, right? Not when we're being jerks in the name of Jesus. That's why humility and being willing to be honest about our own shortcomings, that I don't understand everything, that, God's word can be applied to much more than just my closed system of how I think it's going to happen or my theological system that I think it is. It doesn't mean that there's, it's all relative. It just means I'm still inexperienced and unknowledgeable enough, no matter where I'm at in the journey, that I have more to learn. And that's going to be a very powerful and positive posture to have, especially when you start coming to things that are more contentious, like some of the subjects that Richard just brought up.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, if we shift from the individual to the systemic, right? As Richard was talking about, these economic systems and the healthcare systems and, you know, some of the big political problems that we're seeing right now, those are really systemic. They're not one person causing those. They're just, you know, sort of a product of the fragility of the world that we live in. And so what is our role in either fixing those, or maybe do we fix those? Do we simply highlight the fact that these things are always going to be a little brittle, that this is just part of what it looks like to live in a broken world? And this is all the more reason that we need Christ.
And I think, you know, a lot of the things that are kind of the systemic problems, we got to remember that many of those back 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 500 years ago, many of them were products of Christians coming together and working together for the greater good, to create a system that allowed the least, the last, and the lost to be and embraced, you know, whether that was in terms of health or social standing or economic disaster. And so orphans and widows. And I think that's something that we want to see. And I say we, I mean, a lot of Christ followers that are very frustrated with the status quo. I would love to see smart and dedicated men and women followers of Jesus come into that, not with an axe to grind, not to be ideologues in that negative sense of the word, but to again start collaborating and saying, how can we care for these people that need care? And I'm afraid, you know, whether it's the corporate setting, it tends to be kind of an idolatry of the dollar. And in the political setting, it tends to be, can I win points for the base so I can get reelected, rather than this collaborative, and it's necessarily collaborative, endeavor where, as a result of us working together, learning from each other, we create something that's going to be a benefit to the greater society, all the while still being brittle, because it's
right.
Fallen world. Yeah.
Well, don't you think, Greg, you know, as we look out at some of these systems, we look at the brokenness of the world, you know, we have to recognize and almost channel Paul when he says, you know, one person plants, another waters, but God gives the growth. There's mm-hmm. a very real sense in which the things that we are doing in the world they're just simply not going to fix the world.
Right.
We are trying to do something different. And so when we think about that collaboration and coordination that people can come around to fix, you know, something, or to come up with new solutions to sort of band-aid the world that is falling apart, those solutions really, as we come together, we need to be demonstrating, you know, I go to like Ephesians 3, you know, the manifold wisdom of God in the spiritual realms. I mean, we're not trying to fix this. We are trying to demonstrate the glory of God in visiting the widows and orphans in their affliction. Am I tracking that correctly with you?
No, absolutely. That's where, you know, like we said before, we can't solve, we can't fix. That's above our pay grade, right?
Yeah.
But what we can do, and this is what we need to be more intentional and consistent about doing, is the one thing that God did give us to do, which is to be a means by which people experience His love. That means His kindness, His joy, His hospitality, His grace. Sometimes a kick in the rear, but that's only after we learn that right. And I think that's what, you know, I come from a Lutheran background, and, you know, I joke with people. I say, hey, we can't even save ourselves. Why do we think we're going to save others? Right. That's a theological kind of, you know, bottom line for us. So once we kind of take a deep breath and go, oh, it's not my job to save or to restore all things or to even convince somebody, but to love and to walk with them and then allow that light and salt that will happen along the way, that tasting of the fruit of the Spirit, God will have its effect. And the good news is we got literally thousands of stories of how it works exactly that way. And again, it doesn't work every single time. There's always going to be somebody that successfully gives it a stiff arm, but man, it's the only thing that works. And not surprisingly, that's why, you know, whether it's Ephesians 3 or jump down to Ephesians 5, where he says, be imitators of God, right? Live a life of love, imitating Christ who loved us and gave himself for us. Man, if you were talking about discipling people until the nations are discipled to do what? If it's to imitate Christ and living a life of love, this will be a systemically better world. But if Christians have the banner of partisanship or division or anger or I'm right, you're wrong, then we're just contributors. We're co-conspirators in it going the wrong way, right? And that's what Jesus mostly was fussing at the Pharisees about back in the day.
Yeah, when you think about it, it's really difficult to sort of measure. You know, when you say it's going to be a systemically better world, I tend to agree. But I think sometimes we want to define what better needs to be as opposed to being grateful for what better actually is.
No, good point.
And so in other words, it's like we want things to advance almost unstoppably toward a utopian vision. Right. But the reality is that just being witnesses in the world for Jesus Christ makes the world a better place. In other words, the church really is trying to mirror and reflect the glory of God and to show people what it's like to walk with Christ. And to the extent that we can do that, we are a brighter light in the world that is already dark than we would be if we weren't doing that.
No, well,
but it's
said.
An odd way of thinking about it. You know what I mean?
Well, but it's also very biblical because when we live under the cross, and what that means is not everything is that we're not working towards a utopia, right? There's going to be a moment in time when God brings the new heavens and new earth and all things will be made new. Up until that point, it's not like we're incrementally working towards a utopian existence, but rather that within the broken, fallen, ruined world that we are groaning under, as Paul says, we are light, salt, fruit, you know, the aroma of Christ. And I love the way I think it, Mr. Rogers once said when he was little and there was something disturbing on the news and his mom said, look for the helpers, right? And that's kind of how it's going to be until Christ comes again. It's going to be one scary thing after another. Wars, rumors of wars, famine, pestilence, light and salt, all in the midst of. That's where God's love is getting into the material world through the people who have that love from God to us, through us to them, freely receive, freely give. And as we become more trained and experienced and even skillful in that receiving and then giving, that's what's going to help people, right? And to the degree that we cooperate and collaborate, that'll create some systems for a season that will be helpful as well. Then some corruption will get involved. And we'll have to start all over again.
The vicious cycle. That's all the time we have for this conversation. Next time on Useful to God, we will continue our talk with Greg Finke on the current state of both the sacred and the secular and being set apart. That is what Dr. James Spencer addresses in his new book, Serpents and Doves. Let us know what you think and take a trip to the website at usefultogod.com. I'm Richard Arnold Beatty in the studio at KLTT in Denver. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.